Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, Andrew Frankel, my co-host. We are joined by a guest today who I will introduce in just a moment. Andrew, it's a busy episode.
Yeah.
We're covering lots of ground. There's lots that we want to talk about. I've been driving a Porsche 911 variant that I've been desperate to drive for a long time. We've got a couple of electric cars that we're going to talk about, little and large.
Very small, very big.
Very small and very big.
Yeah.
But we're starting with a bit of news.
Yeah, exciting news for us, certainly, and hopefully for everyone listening to this.
I think so, because the Intercooler is partnering with Pistonheads. I mean, that name is surely going to be familiar to everybody listening to this. Pistonheads is a titan of our world. The classifieds, the forums, the editorial, the videos. It's huge, and we are launching our new partnership with them today. Now, we'll talk to Pete in a moment, who can tell us a bit more about Pistonheads, about the background, about what we're going to be doing together. But actually, it feels like a really significant moment for me, this, because it was 18 years ago that I first got paid to write about cars.
Yeah, and that is a moment you never forget.
Moment you never forget. It's when you become a paid automotive journalist, and when you've been dreaming of doing it for a long time, it's a big deal. And that was for Pistonheads. And on and off, I've worked for Pistonheads ever since. A few years ago, I was doing a lot of video work with Pistonheads. So this is a big deal for me. Now, clearly, there's a huge amount that the Intercooler and Pistonheads can do together over the coming months. So to get us started, let's bring in Pete, who can tell us a bit more. So Pete, how long have you been with Pistonheads?
Yeah, so Pistonheads founded in 1998 as kind of an online website for cars. It really came out of a guy called Dave Edmonston, or Petrol Ted on the forums, who founded this. He decided to take a punt on it as a place for him and his friends to get car news and then chat about cars. So that's where it sort of started from. And he grew it from there to build it up to what it is when I came along, which was when Haymarket bought it off him in 2007. And that's when I went in. So I've been there 17 years, which sounds an incredibly long time. I have been and gone in that period of time, and I've sort of been dragged back three times. So I'm back in, and I'm kind of a new sort of part of trying to build Pistonheads. But back in that 2007, I remember a friend of mine, Ben, saw an advert for it on the front of Pistonheads as they needed a software engineer. That's what I am as background. And I applied. Turns out I found many years later I was the only one who applied.
But you got the job.
Pure lucky. So I got the job. 100% success rate on that application. And it was a crazy time because it was in the Haymarket offices in Teddington, which you've probably both been to.
I lived in for a while.
Some of them have lived in more of those. Yeah. And And we were sort of sat on the side next to Water Car, and mm-hmm. What Car around the corner. There was three of us working on it. Only three of us. Wow. So we had Adam Towler, who's working as editor, Paul Garlick, who is a publisher. And we sat outside Patrick Fuller's office, sort of big name in sort of that Autocar world, and sort of looking at all these journalists over the other side. And I remember in the second week, Paul turned around to me and said, oh, we've got this drive to drive the Gumpert Apollo around Brands Hatch. We need someone with a race license to do it, and you've got a race license because I failed racing driver when I was younger. So I was sent off to drive this car 2 weeks in, looking across at these interns who obviously want to dream of doing that to our first break, go and drive this car around and write about it and put it on the website. And it was just a crazy, surreal thing. It's, you know, I wasn't trying to be a motoring journalist, but I sort of fell into writing occasionally for it.
But that is one of the charms of Pistonheads. If you're, because it's a small team, if you're associated with it, fun things happen. And opportunities come up and you get to get stuck in, don't you?
It's great. And in that 2007 period, it was because we wrote stories. We had to like five stories a day we were trying to get up on the site. Mm. So I remember writing about a bridge being closed in the M1 just because you needed content.
We've all done it.
but the good thing about then, because you go, well, Twitter only started in 2006. Facebook was probably still in universities, hadn't really got out there. And it was one of the few sites where you got instant feedback on anything you wrote from the community.
That was the amazing thing about it. And I can remember thinking it was so innovative. I also just thought, thinking, because what was I doing at the time? I was probably the editor of Motorsport. I was an editor editing something. And I just thought this idea of actually getting your audience to write your content for you was just such a clever idea. And the whole thing about, I mean, the forums, which we just sort of take completely for granted now. Was there anybody else doing it like that back then?
Nobody allowing. So there was lots of forums around, very single make forums around, which is the beauty of Pistonheads, because I think Pistonheads sits as kind of, if you like cars, you sit on Pistonheads. When you have a car, you go into a one make forum and you used to talk there. And then you sell that car, and then there's no point being on that forum.
Yeah,
I still get a birthday request from like the MGZTT Owners Club every year, and I'm like, I don't own one of those cars for years. But Pistonheads always sat there as kind of a place where you could talk about any car, and when you owned a specific car, you went in there, and then you came back to Pistonheads. And I think the thing was about the commentary is it had a lot of mainstream manufacturers even looking at it. I remember we did a piece on when the Vauxhall VXR8 came out, and we did like engine noises of it and a piece. And their boardroom got together to watch the comments come in as we published the review of it, because it was, this is the only way you can get sentiment about a car.
Yeah.
So it's sort of crazy times. And there was another example, which I think it was when Ian Callum, one of your people who write for you, launched the Jaguar XJ, and they created the kind of concept designs, and they got rave reviews across the forum. And then slowly, as kind of you went through the sort of natural progression of releasing a car and got to the spy shots and kind of first people sort of spotting the car, suddenly the sentiment dropped inside the forums. And I can't remember if it was Ian Callum himself or someone who worked in the office phoned up us and said, we're really worried about actually launching this car because we've seen this sentiment drop from really good designs to where we are. That they said, right, we're going to organise an event, get the most kind of influential people from your forums. We're going to set up someone in Barclays and talk through why we've done certain things in the car. And you think now influencers is everywhere. It's like trying to influence people. Mm. But back in those days, it was the single kind of influencing place for forum content.
Mm. And it is still enormous. It's a massive online car community. The forums are thriving. The classifieds have been a mainstay. The editorial is strong consistently on the homepage. So how has PH grown during the years that you've been involved?
Yeah, so over the years, it's very much that classifieds element has grown a lot from when I first started. I think it was much more element. It was more that forums and editorial content. But classifieds has become more a part of it. It's more where, you know, it's where our revenue comes from to try and be able to do all the other stuff. But I think the core has been always about making sure that we write about PH-type cars. Now, that's a really hard thing to define, a PH-type car, because a Fiat Panda 4x4 is probably a PH-type car as well.
But you just know, don't you?
And we were trying to define it the other day, and it's going, it's really hard to define what a PH-type car is. It's just a feeling.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting car.
It is a car that is interesting to people who like cars.
Yes. It's enthusiast cars. And our motto has always been it's like for enthusiasts, by enthusiasts, because everyone who works on the site just love cars. And we just try and do things for the enthusiasts that we would enjoy. So that's that. We write about stuff we enjoy. We try and build functionality that we would enjoy. So if you go in the classifieds, we very much built it in a way that try to match what people do in the forums, which is like, what car can I buy that has this certain criteria? Like it does 0 to 60 in under 5 seconds and can carry my family or that kind of stuff. So 0 to 60 filters in our classifieds is just is a mainstay of what we have. Now we're slightly scuppered by some of the data. You may see a Ford Transit van occasionally in there, but but predominantly it's just a way of trying to search for cars and interesting cars and make it that classifieds more an editorial experience
But is there such a thing as a sort of core car? Is it something like a, I don't know, an E46 M3? Is that sort of, you know, the centre of your universe, or is it really not possible to say what a kind of the absolute sort of core
the
car
is? The backbone car is.
I'd probably say Porsche. It's probably something around Porsche. Yeah. Sometimes we get called Porsche heads, the amount of Porsche stuff we write. I'd say Porsche and BMW is probably key around that.
We get a lot of that.
Yeah, we do.
We get a huge amount of that.
Yes, it's probably fair enough. So Pistonhead's big news at the moment is that you now have an auction platform. And it does seem that these days more and more people are looking to sell and buy their cars that way, premium online auctions. So why is Pistonhead getting involved in that side of the market?
Yeah, so for the car buying, we kind of looked across kind of how you do car buying or how you do car selling across the board. And I think when you're doing car buying, you look at three sort of things you need to do, which is one, does the car match my criteria? That criteria may be, can it fit my family in? Does it do good fuel? But for us guys, it's more, does it drive well? Does it accelerate well? Does it make me look good kind of stuff? So there's this criteria you need to buy a car. The next thing you want to know is, actually, am I paying good money for this car? Am I going to be ripped off? Am I going to find one next week that's far cheaper and far better and have that kind of cognitive dissonance of buying the car? And the third thing is you want to make sure it's reliable. So when you look at selling, they kind of match that criteria, apart from it's mainly time and money. It's like, when do I want to get rid of this car and how fast do I want to get rid of it? And then I take a sacrifice of money to do that.
Yeah,
sure.
So when we kind of looked across that enthusiast buying journey, we see that you've got the ability to part exchange your car in, because if you don't want to keep two with a dealer, or you can sell it privately in the classifieds, but you've got an unknown length of time and you've got to choose the price.
Yeah.
And that's quite challenging when you've got rarer cars, because there's not enough data points for that. And then recently you've got the kind of instant buy your car, but you're taking a sacrifice of money to get rid of the car really quickly. And when we looked across that, we saw auctions actually sits in a nice spot between, it is slightly a semi-distressed sale, because if you get the reserve price right or you have no reserve, you are going to get, that car's going to be gone within the end of the auction because you know it's going to sell, as opposed to a classified which keeps forever. And the other part is you're going to get fair market price for it because it is what someone's going to pay for it. And I, like you guys, I've got a Subaru Impreza WRX STI V2 sitting in my garage. I have not got a clue how much that car's worth. It could be $5,000, it could be $15,000, it could be $25,000. It's really hard. There's none for sale out there. So auctions sits as a way to get more rare cars that you just don't know the value of, but it's the value someone wants to pay. That's the value of a car.
Yeah. And if I was selling a car, particularly at auction, I'd want eyeballs on it. No, that to me would seem like the most important thing. I'd want to give that car the best chance of reaching lots of people, getting lots of bids and going for its true market value. And clearly what you need in that instance is an audience.
Yeah, and that's what we have. We have a natural audience coming for our classifieds. We drop the auction cars into the classifieds so you get visibility. And what we're seeing from those auction cars is that they're getting far more engagement than some of our classified cars. So you get that spotlight on them and surfacing them up. And the other good thing, we sort of talk about the forums and its influence, but we had an Alpina for sale a couple of weeks ago, and the original owner who spec'd the car came onto the thread and talked about that car.
Yeah.
So you actually have that community to support it. You have all those influential people to support it as well. So you can ask questions and answers. And in the auction, because you're buying online, that transparency and trust, which we're trying to get across with lots of photos and lots of details, is really important, the part of that auction process.
And do you think, I mean, to an extent, clearly it's going to come slightly at the cost of classifieds. Do you expect to lose a few classifiers from this, or are they sort of seen as fairly separate entities?
I see them fairly separate. I think they're people are going to have different ways they want to buy and sell cars. I don't think this is a replacement. I think this is just another way for people to buy or sell cars. And I think with classifieds, it's, sometimes you're overwhelmed by the number of cars there. Well, auctions, there's quite a lot of people who are sitting there going, I wonder what itch to scratch next on my car buying or my car journey.
Yeah.
And suddenly this car pops up that you haven't seen one around for ages. We had a Noble M400 turn up. You're going, that's interesting. I might fancy doing that. Or really old Peugeot 206 GTI 1.6 that has been owned by somebody for 18 years. And you're going, that's interesting. I may take a stab on it. So it's actually surfacing up those who are very interested in cars and maybe want to move in the next cars, but you're not really sure what the next car is.
Mm.
So it sort of fits that world as well as those who just feel that, you know, this is a good way of buying a car. I don't have to do that haggling that you get with private sales because it's an agreed number at the end of the day. It takes some of that away.
And you are presumably just facilitating the sales. You're not in any way warranting them or backing the cars or anything else like that, are you?
No, it's quite hard to do that, to actually make it financially work, to be honest, for that to happen. So it is similar to private sales. So what we're trying to do is we talk about that transparency, is make it as honest as possible. And that way you can get that better market value for it. I think if you leave sort of certain parts ambiguous on a description, somebody's got to build that into their head of the bidding going, well, you know, I've got a TVR Camaro, the outriggers might need redoing. So if it's not mentioned in the advert, I'm going, right, I'm going to allocate a certain amount to sort of deal with that and take the bid away. So we actually find the more honest and the more, like, this is where the scrapes are, these are where the damage are,
absolutely,
actually a much better way of getting a higher value.
Well, I always do that. I mean, it's just common sense, isn't it? If somebody's sort of saying, well, this is what's good about this car and this is what's not so great about this car, you know, the sense is, and it's probably fair, that you're dealing with an honest seller. Whereas if somebody only met, oh, this is amazing, you think, well, this car's 25 years old or whatever, it's not going to be perfect. And so what aren't you telling me?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think especially with sort of the Pistonheads members, is they care about cars. Yeah. So,
and they know them as well, don't they? They know cars inside out, a lot of those forum users. There's so much knowledge in there, which must be a huge comfort for buyers, actually. So it's quite early days for your auction platform, isn't it? But what have the highlights been?
Yeah, so it's early days, so we kind of launched it at our 25th anniversary last August. So we kind of trialled it for the last half of the year just to learn loads of stuff, just to work out how it all works. I think sort of the highlights across that probably, let me think. I think the Noble M4400 was a good car because it was just, they're quite rare and unique.
Yeah.
We've had some sort of rarish cars go through. There's some coming up at the moment. So we've got a Formula Ford coming up very shortly, which is quite exciting. And I think it comes with discounted tuition if you want by the Formula Ford champion. So there's a bit of rarity.
Do you get, just generally speaking, in the classifieds as well, do you get competition cars coming through?
We get a few competition cars coming through. I think it's not as much as we... we kind of don't have separate sections for them, so they sort of fall in with anything else, really. But that's kind of, so we're just trying. I think as we kind of experiment out, it's just seeing, does classic cars work as well for audience? Is it modern?
That's right. Yeah, you'll figure it out. You'll figure out what works well on an auction platform, won't you? What sort of price value? What kind of car? What age?
Yeah, because recently we had a BMW Z3M Coupe. Nice little bread fans coming through.
Cool.
Love those little cars.
Yeah.
It was a Cat N because it had a bit of front bumper damage, which you can write any car off in these days with a little scrape. Mm. There's not that many in the classifieds, but that kind of it went for just over £20,000. Which is good value for that kind of car. So I think that was quite interesting. And the other thing we had a Subaru Impreza where somebody, as a Pistonheads member, had taken the 3-litre turbo H6 engine from an Outlook and just went, oh, does that fit in a Subaru Impreza? And just put it in the Subaru Impreza, built it, and decided, well, he's done that kind of thing and wanted to sell it by auction. So there's a complete rare car that a guy from Hungary bought. He flew in.
Wow.
Drove the car back to Hungary. We did check to make sure he made it.
He made it.
Yeah, and he was very happy.
But that's a great example, because how do you figure out what something like that's worth?
Yeah, there's no way. And it's really hard for us when we're trying to even set reserves on cars or have no reserves to go, well, what is the value of this car? And you have to do a lot of research to try and work that stuff out, yeah.
So, I mean, if you are interested in buying a car from Pistonheads Auctions, just head to pistonheads.com. You'll find the auctions page very easily. And if you're interested in selling your car via Pistonheads Auctions, again, go to the homepage, pistonheads.com. Find sell and choose sell by auction and just fill in the form. Do remember to tell them that Pistonhead, that the intercooler sent you. There's a drop down menu. Just select the intercooler, please. Pete, just to finish off here, it's always interesting when someone is sort of in and around the world of auctions, of classifieds, and understands the market and what's going on. I just wonder what sort of, how's the year started out? What are the trends? Because there was a little bit of doom and gloom last year, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think this year, doom and gloom, is it still there? I think it started to steady up. So I don't know whether it's really doom and gloom or whether there was just inflated prices halfway through the year as well.
I think it's a lot of that, isn't it? I think a lot of stuff has been quite expensive for quite a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah. So
and you wonder whether this isn't just a sort of a bit of correction. A natural correction.
Yeah. So I think we've corrected down to sort of the beginning of sort of the 2023 numbers, and we can see that in the data. So we have a lot of asking price data, so I can't tell you what the cars sell for, but we know what people are trying to advertise them for across the board. And I think we're seeing, one, that you're just seeing that kind of market correction that's happening. Two, I think as you go through a market correction, dealers are just being more savvy about the stock they bring into their forecourt, because they just don't want a depreciating car sitting on their lot. Well, when cars are appreciating, you can take a gamble. It's just making money as it sits there if you sell it. And then I think there is a little bit of a price challenge for people buying cars. So sub-enthusiast cars under 20K are actually doing reasonably well. It's the richer stuff that's actually dropping. And a really good example is if you look at like M3s across the board, different generations of M3s, you can see that the sort of the newer M3s, they've probably dropped 10% in the last 6 months.
Wow.
But you're now seeing kind of the sort of the older models, not the E30, because that just went nuts in like 2016.
These,
but the 46s and it's kind of the 36s, and those are all sort of converging at 20 grand. They're all ending up about the same price, which is crazy, because I would say the V8 is probably the better one of all those ones. But they're all converging where they are, and they're sort of staying steady. So you're seeing that like the older cars come up, you're seeing the newer cars go down, which is really interesting. And there's some other little trends. You know, you take Fiesta STs, the ST3s are doing well, the ST2s are doing rubbish. But
are they?
No. Yeah,
so it matters that much.
So it's like even down at that kind of level. Wow. I think the announcement, the Fiesta finishing, is probably sort of helped some of those things across the board. Mm. But yeah, it's just across. And electric cars, especially premium electric cars, they've seen drops as well. But I think that's well advertised, especially Teslas. But that goes across to the e-tron and all the other versions.
Yeah, everything, I'm sure. Okay, well, we need to leave it there. But Pete, thanks for coming in and telling us all about Pistonheads and Pistonheads' new auction platform. It'll be interesting to catch up a little bit later in the year. Maybe we'll see what the market's up to. You can tell us more about what's come through the auction platform. But, I mean, the Intercooler and Pistonheads are going to do plenty over the next few months. So I'm really looking forward to it. Let's get stuck in and make the most of it.
Really excited. Thanks, guys.
Great. Thank you. Not at all.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Andrew, electric cars then, little and large.
Yeah.
Right? So I drove the little one.
Yes.
Why does it work out this way? Why do I drive the relatively underpowered, relatively inexpensive one, and you drive the Rolls-Royce Spectre? There's a clear pecking order here, isn't there?
Well, I'm not sure. I've been trying to drive the Spectre for a very... Oh, no, actually, no, because I've driven the little one that you had, that you had a go, and I drove it a little bit ago. And then maybe just people sort of look at me and think that you're sort of naturally plutocratic, and those are the sort of guys you ought to be seen wafting about in.
Yes, so I had a go in an Arbath 500E. You've been driving the Rolls-Royce Spectre.
Yes.
I mean, those are as close as the two bookends of the electric car world as you can get at the moment.
Mm.
So, Arbath 500E, it's a fun, charming little thing. I actually preferred it significantly, dynamically, to any other petrol Arbath that I'd driven. This one actually felt like it had...
Yeah, I mean, that's because actually the underlying proposition, the platform it's on, if you just drive a normal electric Fiat 500, it's really good.
I'm sure.
Whereas the old Fiat 500, I'm sorry for all the millions of people who have them and they're... They look nice, but they just weren't very good cars in terms of, you know, their ride was shocking. They didn't handle. They didn't steer.
Yeah.
They just weren't. And, you know, and you can put as many Arbath stickers on it, give as much power. You're just not going to get around that. Mm. I never drove one. I never drove one I liked.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's probably fair. But this thing, it is a fun little thing. Dynamically much better than other Arbaths I've had a go in. I think it looks super cool as well. It's got a few problems. Let's be honest about this. First of all...
One particular one, which I didn't really come across, but you did big time.
Yeah, so the first issue is that it's not cheap, and this is a fairly common thread through EVs at the moment, isn't it? It's 38 grand. 38 grand for a little electric car.
Goodness me. I mean, if you think about, well, when they stopped selling it, what you'd have paid for a Fiesta ST.
Mm. Mm.
You know, it would have been... I don't know, £15,000-16,000 less than that.
Yeah.
It would have been early 20s, wouldn't it?
And way more fun to drive.
Way more fun to drive. Yeah, and you didn't have to park it for however many hours every time you ran out of juice. And I mean, it's a really... The thing is electric cars, particularly electric cars like that, they're all what I call qualification cars. You always have to qualify what you're saying. You can say, this is a really, really good car for an EV, for a small electric EV. You never had to qualify a Fiesta ST. You just said, this is a fantastic car.
Mm.
Full stop.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of the qualifications. With me on board, it's a 1,500 kilogram car.
Yeah.
We know EVs are heavy. We know they're going to get lighter. The technology will improve. Perhaps there'll be a quantum leap in battery tech at some point.
Yeah,
but until then...
How long have we been waiting for that? I mean, I've been in business 35 years and I've, you know... The next big thing's always just around the corner. It's like hydrogen. It's always 10 years away. Hydrogen's been 10 years away ever since I've got in this business 35 years ago. And, you know, there are some really quite encouraging, because the whole solid state thing was once there was a time, wasn't it, when Dyson was doing his car and that was going to be very exciting and they were going to, you know, nail solid state, which everybody knows is in theory is the perfect solution and in practice is almost impossible to productionize. There are some quite exciting conversations now starting to happen about maybe you could do it after all. But we have been here before, haven't we?
Mm.
So, you know, I'm gonna wait until that happens before I start getting excited about that.
So the thing about the Arbath is, it's a little electric car. It doesn't have a huge battery. I think 42 kilowatt hours or something, maybe a bit bigger. And so inevitably the range is limited.
Mm.
They say it'll do 158 miles WLTP. Of course, when it's cold, that's much less.
And when you're driving it.
The other issue is, if it was a pure city car, if it's a Fiat 500e, and it really does just live in the city, and maybe sometimes you go along a motorway where there is a good charge network, that kind of range is okay. But a sporting EV, a hot hatch, the idea of that, surely, certainly to me, is that you get out of the city, you get away from the main arterial routes, you get into the hills, into, you know, more remote parts, drive a car like that the way it should be driven on roads like that, and you're not going very far before you have to go and find a charge point somewhere. You are not going very far, and that was actually a bigger problem for me in terms of going out for a fun drive than the lack of sound, than the lack of a manual gearbox or any of that stuff. It was range anxiety.
The problem is it's always in the back of your head. So, you know, picture the scene. It's a Saturday or it's a Sunday, and you want to go meet a mate in a pub or take your dog for a walk, whatever, somewhere. And, you know, it's 50 miles away. Okay, and you're thinking, well, okay, you've got a full charge now, but it's a bit uphill and down dale, and I am going to want to drive it in a quite spirited way. 50 miles there, 50 miles back, probably do a bit of messing around while there. And you're going to be thinking, I'm probably going to have to factor in some kind of stop at some place. And A, that is not what you want to be doing at your weekend. B, there is going to be this anxiety, which you will know all about, you know, is there going to be a charging point available? How fast is it going to charge? You know, how long am I going to just be sat there at my weekend twiddling my thumbs, doing something which otherwise I would not have to do? And that, to me, would just, it would just slightly take the edge off my enjoyment of the day knowing that that was just waiting for me.
I think I feel a bit sunnier, a bit rosier, a bit more optimistic about all this stuff than you do. I'd actually, and I suspect you would as well, I'd love to have a little EV at home, purely for coming into town, for knocking around the city.
Absolutely.
I'd really enjoy that. I had to bring the M2 into Bristol for a hospital appointment for my daughter. And parking around the Children's Hospital is a nightmare.
Yeah.
And we were wedged into a tiny space.
Yeah.
It's a two-door car. So it's very difficult to open the door and get her in and out. And I just thought, you know, if I had a little tiny electric car right now, this would be fantastic.
Yeah.
That, for me, is what they are for. That's what they're good at.
You know, and I live, so we're in a studio in Bristol at the moment, and I live about 30 miles away.
Mm.
Most of which is either motorway or city drive. I have no interest in driving anything interesting on a route like that. If I had a little Renault Zoe or something like that, so you just nip in, nip out, park it anywhere, be completely unobtrusive, perfect.
Mm.
But the problem is that, we mustn't go on about it because it's what we always say. It therefore has to be a second car.
Mm.
And you have to have, you know, off-street parking so you can charge it at home. And therefore, it means they're not for everyone. They're not these great democratizing machines that some people seem to think that they are.
The issue for me is that when you need them to do something else, something other than just zip around the city, you are then limited.
Mm.
But it's more of an issue with something that is trying to be a bit sporty. Because, as I say, it should be driven in a certain way. It should be driven on a certain road. So it was an eye-opening experience for me. But I, when we had lots of charge and I was on a great road, I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the other bookend.
The big one.
Because people have been saying for years, haven't they, that electrification, full electrification, will suit a Rolls-Royce perfectly.
Well, I mean, they did one. I drove, what was it? Was it the 100 EX concept car about... Well, it must have been 10, 11
On a years. Phantom, was it?
It was on a Phantom.
Yeah.
I went and drove it. I went and wafted around West Sussex in it for half a day. And I just thought, if ever a car would really, really benefit from electrification, this is it. It was fabulous.
Mm.
And so is the Spectre.
Yeah.
It's I'll get to one or two drawbacks in a minute. But just as a thing to be in, to do those things that you want a Rolls-Royce to do, it is absolutely incredible. It is the quiet. So, I mean, it's one of those things where because it's so quiet, because you just feel so completely at peace in it, I think it kind of kids you into believing other stuff, which may or may not be true. Because, I mean, I can't believe, for instance, how well it rides.
Really?
Now, maybe that's because it rides that well. Maybe it's because I'm in such a sort of relaxed mood because it is so unbelievably quiet. I'm just feeling fantastically well disposed towards it. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's not exactly a new thought, but you know, the weight doesn't matter on a Rolls Royce. It's 2.95 tons.
Okay? That's a lot, isn't it?
Which means it's well over three before basically anybody's got in it.
Yeah.
And that's before options. But if ever a car could get away with weighing 3 tons, goodness, it's a Rolls Royce.
Mm-hmm.
The instant torque. And they've actually programmed the throttle in a very sensitive way because it's not like a Tesla which just goes bang.
Just shoots off the line.
It doesn't do that.
Yeah.
It's actually, I think it might be probably the fastest accelerating Rolls-Royce there is, but it doesn't feel, it does it in a very elegant, very Rolls-Royce kind of way. There's the silence and yeah, it's just perfect. It's a perfect, for want of a better word, powertrain for a car like that. Mm. It just works really, really well. Apart from, and maybe these things don't, I've been wondering whether these things matter or not in a Rolls-Royce. I reckon it's practical. I think the WLTP range is a sort of like 320, something like that. When it came to me, when it came on a truck and it said it was fully charged, it had an advertised range of, I think, about 260. And I think that probably means that most people most of the time would struggle to get much more than 200 miles out of it. And then obviously, because it's got a battery the size of an oil tanker in it, you know, you're going to need to be parked for quite a long time, particularly if you're at home, to charge it up again. It doesn't charge very quickly. It's
really?
Got a 400-volt system. It's not an 800-volt system like even, you know, Hyundais and Kias give you these days, let alone Porsches, which surprised me a bit. I think what Rolls-Royce would say is, well, it doesn't really matter because it'll be somebody's seventh or eighth car.
Mm.
And it will be a high days and holidays cars. It will be. But I just think a car like that is a car I'd want to use because it is such a wonderfully nice place to be. It's such a great thing to be in. I'd want to be in it all the time. And I don't know, but I imagine your typical Rolls-Royce customer is probably a bit more unwilling to spend their time sat at motorway filling stations while their car charges up than other people. So I'd be interested in thinking about, in the thinking behind that. There is a bit too much BMW in it.
Mm.
So, you know, I've come out of a M340i touring long-termer, and I knew exactly how all the infotainment would work instantly.
Yeah.
It does. It was not entirely touchscreen.
Not that it's bad, I'm sure.
It's not bad at all, no. Yeah. And they've still got a controller, which is very nice. No, it's not bad at all. But what it doesn't do is, you know, in a Phantom where the sort of the screen disappears, so you just basically got a slab of wood, it doesn't do that. So it's always there. Little things like that. But, I mean, I am sort of being a bit pernickety here. It is a fantastic thing to just stooge about the place in.
Mm. So do you think that clearly is the future then for Rolls-Royce powertrains? Big battery and a couple of motors?
Yeah, I think...
Do away with the V12s?
I think there will always be the diehard traditionalists. I think there will be people, and Rolls-Royce will continue to want to build the cars that its customers want them to build, and I think that they will continue to do the V12s for as long as they possibly can. But I think they will become an increasingly niche product. And I think it'll be one of those occasions, we've been here before with cars, haven't we, where people buy the V12 knowing it's not the best option, and they don't care because they want a V12. They want a V12 Rolls-Royce. And I kind of get that. But would I rather... Given that, you know, we're not talking about sort of, you know, handling or dynamism or driving particularly fast, would I rather, you know, do what I've done, spend 5 days wafting about in a Spectre or a Ghost? I'd rather be in the Spectre.
Mm.
It does more of the things I want a Rolls-Royce to do and does them better. And that's surely what a Rolls-Royce should all be about.
Mm. Gosh. Well, there you go. Rolls-Royce Spectre. Okay. So finally...
Yeah,
I've at long last driven a 911 Dakar.
Hey, there you go.
Ever since we saw the spy shots of that, do you remember those spy shots of clearly a 911 riding a bit higher?
Mm.
And we all thought, what's that?
Yeah.
What are they up to? And then the rumours kind of swirled, and then they were, the announcement that they were building what's essentially I still don't know what to call that kind of car, off-road sports car maybe. I don't know what it is. But it is a new breed of performance car, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is in a little niche at the moment. There's only the Dakar and the Huracan Sterrato.
Indeed.
But that'll change.
Mm. There'll be more, won't there?
Tell me what you think. Did you like it?
I liked it a lot. I mean, I only drove it on the road. I didn't drive it. You drove it through the flipping Sahara Desert, so we've had slightly different experiences. I was in... Where was I? I was in the hills just outside Bristol. So not the Sahara Desert. But do you know what? I'm not sure, even if I had the money, I'm not sure I would ever be brave enough to rattle my own, 80,000 pound car over gravel and rocks and all the rest of it. I don't know if people would do that, will they?
No, but that's not what the car's actually about, is it?
No.
The fact that it can is very nice. But, you know, goodness knows, there are all sorts of cars which do all sorts of things, which they never actually get to do in the real world, and they still get bought for those reasons. People just like to know that they can do them.
Like 200 miles an hour.
200 miles an hour. Like, you know, Range Rovers going up the side of mountains, that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Mm. But, yeah, the fun of it actually isn't that you can go and pretend you're doing the Dakar Rally.
Yeah.
It's that on the road... you've got a bit more ground clearance. You've got a bit less grip. It was on the Scorpion tyres.
Yeah.
So the
Are there three different options? Is there a super knobbly tyre and a...
No, I think there's a Scorpion, okay. Which is the sort of standard on-off-road tyre. And you can get a summer tyre for it and you can get a winter tyre.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
So that is the most off-roady tyre
that
they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the point about it is that you have a bit less grip. You have a bit more ground clearance. You have a bit more body movement.
Mm. A bit more sidewall, just a bit more...
Yeah.
Mm,
it's actually heading off in... the opposite direction to a lot of modern track-focused sports cars, which have more grip, at least in the dry, stiffer suspension, you know, lower ride heights, less body movement, which is great if you're driving on track. But it's kind of, when you're on the road, what you find is that you're driving faster and faster and faster just to try and feel something, just to try and feel the car.
Absolutely.
Edge up against its own limits. And that can be frustrating. In the Dakar... you don't get that.
No.
You don't get that at all. It's lovely.
You can enjoy so much more of what the car does.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go totally bananas.
No.
And then the sort of added benefit is it's an all-round car. Right through winter, even if it's snowing, when the roads are in a terrible state, as they often are towards the end of winter, when it's wet and soggy and miserable outside, away you go.
I mean, I have so often... I have fantasized about getting a Dakar.
Mm.
In dark grey or something like that,
taking
all the badges off it,
making
it look as un-Dakar as possible, and that's it. That's the car you spend the rest of your life in. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Brilliant.
And you never call it the Dakar. It's just your daily steer. It happens to be a 911.
Yeah,
and it wouldn't matter what the world threw at you.
Mm.
You just keep going.
You would. You really would. As standard, from the factory, they come with just two seats. I don't know why they do that. I don't know why they take the rear seats out. But of course...
I didn't know that. Do they really?
Yeah. But of course, there are people who will put them back in for you.
Yeah, but is it homologated with only two seats?
I guess so.
That's very strange.
Mm.
I'm amazed I didn't know that.
But you can get them put back in, I think, any 911. So, well, certainly if it doesn't have a cage. So people are doing it to GT3 Tourings.
Yeah.
Which, all of a sudden, particularly if you've got little ones, makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Wow.
So that is on the fantasy list for me. 911 Dakar, rear seats. Yeah, muted spec.
Yeah.
Scorpion tyres.
Yeah.
That would see me through. Okay, right, well, let's wrap that one up there. Thank you, everybody, for listening, or for watching, if you did, on YouTube. Hopefully, by now, you know that we are in a studio recording these, and we're filming them, and we're making the full episodes available on YouTube. So for those lunatics who want to see us, as well as listen to us...
Hard to imagine, though it is.
You now can. So however you're listening or watching, please just subscribe, whether that's to the YouTube channel, whether that's to the podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever app you might be using. Just hit the follow button or the subscribe button. And remember, we'll be back here, same time, same place, next week.
See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.